had stakes pulled up, and both groups left the banks of the Nidwalden. Gifford and Roan rocked together in the back of the wagon as the Imperial host rolled west. Neither knew where they were headed, and Gifford honestly didn't care. Even after several days' rest, he remained exhausted. Where they had found the strength to hike from the swamp of Ith to Avampartha, he couldn't fathom. Rain was with them, but Moya and Tekchin were in a different wagon. The one Gifford, Roan, and Rain rocked in was filled with bushels of grain and barrels of wine. They bounced and shimmied along the bridge road that cut a straight line through the Harwood. Sitting down on the bed of the wagon with its high wooden sides, all Gifford could see were the snowy tops of huge trees. Rain was being his normal, quiet self and spent much of his time looking at the sword he now carried. But in truth, all of them were quiet. The loss of Bryn had killed any sense of pride or feeling of victory.
"Who do you think did it?" Gifford asked his wife. "Who killed Bryn? If I could find him. If I could do that much."
Roan shook her head. "What?" he asked. "Whoever was up there didn't kill her." Gifford narrowed his eyes at his wife, confused. Sitting opposite them, in among bags of grain, Rain's head came up off his chest. "He didn't push her. She jumped." Gifford considered this for the first time.
"The key is still inside well."
He sat up excited.
"Maybe she can..."
Again, Roan shook her head. "Her body is gone. Even if she can find it, it'll be too late. She won't return to us. But I think she went back for a reason."
"Tesh and Twessa?"
Roan smiled.
"Do you think she can help them?"
"I think there are few things beyond Bryn's ability to conquer."
"Then I think the Typhons should look out."
They both bounced along in silence for a time. Rain shifted position. He had made an awkward but comfortable seat out of the grain sacks and sat back down.
"Any idea where we're going?"
"Southwest," Roan said.
"Yes, but to where?"
Gifford tried to shrug and failed. It was taking some effort to adjust to his old body.
"Oh, that's white. You have a destiny to fulfill."
"How are you going to manage that?" Roan asked. "You, Frost, and Flood were banished from Belgrig." Rain nodded, then shrugged.
"Don't know."
He picked up a feather that was lying in the bed of the wagon, having fallen to the floor when he moved the bags of grain. He spun it absently between his fingers.
"Persephone and Nephron were talking about building a new city. And I was thinking, for now, that Frost, Flood, and I could help. Belgric Lungrians are good at that."
"What about your future wife?"
"Oh, I'm sure I'll be heading in that direction eventually. I'm sure I'll know when the time is right."
Gifford was nodding, but Roan was staring at the feather Rain twirled. "That's not a feather." Gifford and Rain looked at each other, then back at her.
"Sure it is. I think it's from a duck," Rain said.
Roan was shaking her head adamantly.
"No, it's not."
She reached over and plucked it from the dwarf's hand.
"Look," she pointed to the tip where the hollow shaft had been cut to a point. "This is a quill, one of Bryn's quills."
Roan got to her hands and feet and crawled over the bags and around the wine barrels.
"She was in here, and..."
Roan snatched up a bundle. She drew it back and set it on her lap. Unfolding the wool wrap revealed a bound book.
"Bryn's book,"
Gifford said. Roan opened the cover and flipped through page after page of black marks on parchment.
"Can you read it?"
he asked his wife.
Flipping back to the first page, she caught a lock of hair, twirled it into a tight string, and put it into her mouth.
Chapter 33. The First Empire.
I shall henceforth endeavour to piece together all that is known of such said era, which is now recognised by all contemporary scholars as the Age of Myth and Legend. I will record in honest detail and objective discourse how Novron the Great did win the Elven War and establish our grand empire through courage, valour, and for the love of Persephone, a simple farmer's daughter. Migration of Peoples by Princess Farallane. On her 52nd birthday, the day the city was to be officially named and dedicated, Persephone woke up coughing. Her chest hurt from the hacking, and she rolled over and spat into the bucket beside the bed. She steadied herself before coughing and spitting again.
More blood than usual.
Bringing up blood wasn't good, and the fever, chills, chest pains, and sore throat weren't much of a warm hug either. Even so, she'd had those other ailments for weeks, and the blood was a relatively new occurrence. The way it stained the interior of the bucket left her uneasy, as if she had one foot off the edge of a cliff and the other was slipping. She lay across the bed on her stomach, staring down, until she noticed the sunshine coming in the windows. Spring mornings had a different kind of light, a softer, more hopeful radiance. Happy light, she thought. Along with the morning shine came the sound of hammering, distant shouts, and laughter mixed with birdsong. For a moment, Persephone believed she was back in the lodge in Dol Ren. Her hand fanned out across the covers, searching for Eglin. But that side of the bed was empty. Had been for years.
This isn't Dol Ren.
People called the outpost New Ren, or Renyid in the Frey tongue. Old Ren was on the other side of the Barn Urum River. This place, this side of the rivers, was known as Avalin, the Green Land in Frey. But for runes, it had always been the Forbidden Lands. A man had once been killed for being where they were now. That man's son had long dreamed of coming back. He never made it. Persephone swallowed. That hurt too. Everything did these days. She rolled over so she could see out the window. Her bedroom was up 5 stories. The height still disturbed her, but it provided a perfect view of the city.
By Mara, it's ugly.
What had been a lovely green hill overlooking the Urim River had been torn into a muddy mess. After so many years, all they had managed to accomplish was to scar Elan's face, turning a natural beauty into a hideous blemish. Nefren wasn't one for the Elwyn tradition of natural harmony. He and his staff of Belgric-Lungrian designers had their own vision of how the world ought to be. Straight roads, square buildings, and stone. Lots and lots of stone. Thousands of men and hundreds of dwarfs laboured on scaffolds, using wheels and pulleys to lift brick and block. None of the buildings were finished, and everyone suffered equally under temporary roofs of wooden planks. The Grand Marchway, as Nefren euphemistically called it, was a line of muck this time of year. In summer, the mud dried, but the city was infested with biting flies and broiled in unrelenting heat. In winter, everyone froze because the buildings were up high, made of stone, and there weren't any natural windbreaks. Persephone would have preferred a log lodge. The way Nefren kept adding to the city, she wondered if it would ever be finished. But her husband was intent on dedicating the place that afternoon. He had a special ceremony planned where he would unfurl the dragon banners and give a speech from the balcony of the palace, the dome of which was still under scaffolding. Persephone rolled back and collapsed, a rasping in her chest. She felt exhausted and hoped she would feel better soon. Nefren would want her with him for the dedication. She heard a light tap on her door as if a mouse was rapping, and without a pause, Justine's head peeked in. The woman who had once been Nolan's nurse had become Persephone's.
Are we awake?
You seem to be.
So it looks like we are, Persephone croaked out, then coughed again. Justine stepped inside. Sunlight splashed across her face, revealing the growing threads of grey invading the woman's once dark hair.
When did that happen?
How are you this morning?
The woman had a serious concern in her voice, a tone that was practically suspicious.
Better.
Are you just saying that because I sound worried?
Scared you, huh?
Justine nodded with a series of fast, shallow bobs and a false smile.
Do I look like I did last night?
Persephone challenged. She had no idea what the answer to that question might actually be, but given that she no longer felt like hungry rats were nesting inside her chest, she took a gamble.
No,
Justine conceded. She dragged the word out with reluctance while studying Persephone's face.
But you always look fine in the morning.
This was true. Persephone's mornings were usually her best times. Her afternoons were iffy, and her nights horrific. The last one hadn't only scared Justine, who had actually cried at one point, but Persephone had felt that second foot slip too. She'd had trouble breathing. A great deal of trouble. She felt as if she were drowning, and once more recalled the face of Morton Whipple. That poor little boy hadn't changed a bit. He was still trapped under the ice.
Can I get you anything? Water? Food?
Persephone shook her head. This made Justine scowl.
You have to eat.
I'll just spit it out again if I do.
The worry crawled back onto Justine's face.
Maybe later,
Persephone offered. Justine slowly nodded.
If you're up to it, there's someone here to see you.
Nolan? She asked.
Justine shook her head with a sympathetic frown.
No, he's with Zephyrin and Bran. They're helping with decorations. Do you want me to get him? He's not far away. He asked me to let him know if...
What?
Do you want me to send for him?
No, he was here all last night. He slept in that chair, or tried to.
And I feel better, don't I?
You tell me.
I have a better idea. Why don't you tell me who this visitor is?
An old friend, although he doesn't look as old as he should. He's waiting. I told him I had to see if you were up to a visit.
Who is it?
Justine smiled, and without answering, she returned to the door, opening it wide.
Malcolm, she'll see you now.
The man hadn't changed a bit. No grey hair on him, no pot belly, no wrinkles around his eyes. He could have been one of Nolan's older friends. Persephone had come to terms with him being far from ordinary. He could see the future and gave brave adventurers keys to the underworld. Malcolm had helped her from the very start, and ultimately, he was responsible for the runes winning the war peacefully. She would forever be in his debt.
Malcolm! She shouted, and then coughed. Watch yourself!
Justine snapped. Persephone held out her arms. Malcolm crossed the room in three long strides and embraced her.
It's been so long, Persephone said. I thought I would never see you again. Have you visited with Nephron?
No, he replied softly, sitting on the bed beside her. Judging everything to be satisfactory, Justine grabbed the empty water pitcher and left the room.
Have you seen Nolan? He'll be thrilled, and you must meet Bran, Bran's son. The boy is growing like a salafan plant. He's taller than I am now.
Again he shook his head.
What about Moya, Tekchin, and Zephyrin? Oh,
you probably don't know their daughter, do you?
I haven't seen anyone. I came here only to see you.
This didn't surprise her. Persephone wished it did, but she'd guessed it the moment he entered. The man's timing had always been impeccable, and she realized now that Malcolm never showed up anywhere by accident. The last time he'd appeared out of nowhere was just before Padera died.
What are What do you think of the city? Nephron is very proud of his creation. Has a whole army of... Oh, did you hear Rain has been crowned the new Dwarven King? Frost and Flood can't believe it. He has pardoned them. They say they will go home after finishing Nephronronia, but I wonder if that will ever happen. Nephron keeps making it bigger. They're actually putting in waste tunnels that Roan suggested. That's a huge project. Personally, I think the dwarfs just like digging holes.
Persephone,
you can call me Seth. You've known me long enough.
He smiled.
It was a sad smile.
Persephone, it doesn't end here.
You aren't wearing your Lee Moore.
She pointed at his tailored tunic.
I'm afraid they're falling out of fashion. All the young people are wearing tunics now, and jackets. You've probably seen them. And the girls, they have these dresses where the top halves are stitched tight, fitted to their bodies. Not exactly decent. They say the new clothes are more freeing. Well, I've seen the way the men look at them, and it isn't luxury of movement that these girls are after.
I think it helps if you understand that it doesn't end here, Malcolm went on. Persephone looked down at the bed. When she looked back up, her lower lip trembled.
Malcolm, I think I picked wrong. I think I failed. I think I messed everything up.
No, you didn't.
He took her hand in his and gave a soft squeeze. But Nephron is...
She rolled her eyes.
Nephronronia. He's actually going to name it that.
No, he won't.
Of course he will. They're having the ceremony this afternoon. His arrogance has gotten the better of him.
She took a breath.
He should name it after Nolan, but he won't let his son have anything. The two are already at odds. Do you know what Nolan means? Do you know why I picked it?
She sighed. I fear I chose wrong. I only thought...
Persephone, when the runes of Alenrist have lain buried for so long that no one remembers what the strange bluish stones sticking out of the ground are, or how they got there, the age you lived in will be remembered as an age of myths and legends. People, your people, will live in an era of unparalleled prosperity. This city will stand for centuries and never have need for walls. Wraith's dream of living in the land of green will be magnified beyond his ability to imagine. At the sound of his name, tears slipped down her cheeks. She nodded.
Nephron should name this city after Wraith. It's really his city. His dream finally realized. He always wanted to make something good and lasting.
She fixed Malcolm with an intense stare.
Will it? Will this city, will this empire and the peace it was built on stand forever?
Forever? Malcolm looked pained. That's a very long time.
Will it last?
Malcolm shook his head. I don't think so.
You don't think so? You know everything, Malcolm. You knew to come here today.
He bowed his head and sighed. It was supposed to last. That had been the plan. But there is a dark spot on the landscape of the future, a shadow into which I cannot see. Wasn't there before, but it is now. The Book of Bryn went into that hole.
This surprised Persephone. Roan has Bryn's book. She's been teaching Bran to read it.
Malcolm shook his head. She has but a tiny portion. The first part. The flawed part. The rest disappeared with Bryn. That wasn't supposed to happen. Many things shouldn't have. The Belgric-Lungrians weren't supposed to attack the Frey, and the Frey weren't supposed to learn the art and nearly annihilate the world with it. Malcolm shook his head in dismay. 2 steps forward, 1 step back.
Why does that happen?
I'm not sure, but I'm certain it's not good.
Persephone felt the rats waking up in her chest
and felt a weight pressing down.
It was getting harder to breathe again. She looked out the window at the morning sun. It was such a pretty day.
Do you see anything hopeful? Or was it all for nothing?
Not for nothing. I won't let it be for nothing. I'm not the sort to give up.
But can you see anything positive in the future? Tell me something encouraging, Malcolm. I need to hear that things will work out. That there is hope for my people. For all people.
Malcolm nodded. I see a baby, a descendant of yours, crying in the dark, born on a cold night in a despicable city very near here. His parents have been murdered, and he is forgotten and ignored. The woman who takes him from his dead mother's arms will abandon him in a gutter less than a week after he takes his first breath. He has no chance of survival, and the fate of the world rests with him.
That's not helping, Malcolm.
Persephone wiped the tears from her face. She could feel the fluid welling up in her chest, and the rats building a nest in there didn't like it one bit.
Then let me tell you something that will. I'm going to make you a promise.
He leaned in and whispered, as if he feared someone might be listening.
I swear I'll be there on that cold night when he cries alone in the gutter.
He squeezed her hand, and she knew this was meant as a covenant, a solemn vow he wasn't making lightly.
When the world turns its back, I'll pick him up and deliver him to safety. And I'll watch over that child when he faces his most difficult challenges. I'll do this for you. So through his strength, a woman very much like yourself will one day sit on the throne of the world and rule with wisdom and compassion and change everything.
Persephone rubbed the pain in her chest. The one who you speak of, this man from the gutter who will save the world, will he be as courageous as Moya and as steadfast as Gifford? Will he be as selfless as Wraith and Suri and as intelligent as Bryn and Roan?
Surely he must be all of these things to ultimately succeed where they failed.
Malcolm frowned and looked down at his feet.
What's wrong, Malcolm? Tell me the truth.
He frowned and shook his head.
No, the man I speak of will not be great. He'll be a terrible person, detestable, murderous, cruel, and untrusting.
Persephone stared, bewildered.
How could... I don't understand. How can such a person make the world better?
Malcolm's head snapped up, and he looked as if she had slapped him. He appeared deeply hurt. She could see the pain and shock in his eyes,
eyes that were deeper than any man's should be. He looked away, staring out at the horizon. As he did, she saw tears well and slipped down his cheeks.
Then he sucked in a weary breath. Because I hope that no one is beyond redemption, and anyone can correct the misdeeds of their past, he told her in a weak voice.
He took another breath. I believe this to be true. I have to.
Malcolm let go of her hand, stood up, and started for the door.
Malcolm,
she said, stopping him. He turned.
What will they name the city? You said it wouldn't be Nephronronia, and we both know you can see the future. So what then? Later today at the dedication. I doubt I'll be in any condition to attend. So, tell me, what will Nephron call it?
Malcolm paused a moment, then replied, Persepolis.
The city of Persephone?
She looked stunned.
But why?
He offered her one last sad smile, in memory of you.
Muriel knew who was knocking at the door to her little hut before she opened it.
she knew before the knock. She had known hours ago, but made him knock anyway. She felt it was good for him to wait. She might have made tea, could have set out wine. The occasion was so rare it certainly warranted it. Muriel didn't bother. They weren't friends, and this wasn't to be a cordial meeting. Muriel had been in the process of sewing up a bag of goose feathers, the tiny down plucked from the chests of hundreds of waterfowl. She would have a wonderful pillow when she was done, but finishing it would need to wait. She got up from her stool and opened the door. She hadn't seen him in the flesh in centuries, hadn't so much as bothered to eavesdrop or even sneak a peek. She could, and had, in the early days. Not that she was at all interested. Muriel just wanted to make sure he was leaving her alone. He promised to keep his distance, but he was also a habitual liar. However, until that day, she'd never even caught him spying. That was the first wrinkle in her perfectly made bed, the one where her father wasn't the architect of all that was bad merely in her life, but in the world as a whole. She hadn't expected him to really leave her alone, but he had. He respected her privacy as well, which was as jarring as seeing rain fall up. Sending the key to her was the second wrinkle. Muriel preferred a smooth, simple bed to lie in. Wrinkles were not just unsightly, they were uncomfortable. He didn't look any different. Couldn't. Neither of them ever changed. At least on the outside. His hair could have been cut or grown out, but it wasn't. The clothes were different. The last time she'd seen him, he'd worn his full regalia, a magnificent robe that changed colour, a scarlet living mantle that enveloped and stroked him with affection, and, of course, the crown of light. He had none of those old trappings. The man standing in her doorway wore a stained wool shirt with the sleeves rolled up to the elbows. The front was left loose, tie strings hanging, his collarbone showing, a pool of sweat in the cleft. His pants, though rolled up to the knees, were wet. The hair on his calves slicked. He walked across the inlet. He actually walked here. Probably thinks that impresses me. He had a crude spear over his shoulder with a bag tied to it. Not a bag, another shirt. He had food in it. Berries were staining the bottom a reddish blue. I won't forgive you, she greeted him.
I know, he said, setting the spear down, leaning it against the wall to the right of the doorframe.
They stared at each other for a long time, like the game where one tries not to blink. Out in the yard, her ducks waddled and quacked, and birds sang. All of them were oblivious to the historic meeting.
Are you going to ask me in?
No. She folded her arms.
Then why invite me?
Who said I invited you? He looked at her then with a winsome smile. Seeing her reaction, he quickly buried it.
You kept the key, so I would come. I consider that an invitation.
It's been 16 years. Why come now?
I was visiting a friend in the area.
Those people you sent, they were very convincing. That's why you sent them, isn't it? To soften me.
Did they?
I invited you, didn't I?
He smiled again. But you still haven't asked me in. He tried to look around her, seeking a glimpse inside her hut.
And I won't. Muriel pulled the key from around her neck and held it out to him. He looked at it for a long moment.
No, he finally said, shaking his head.
What do you mean, no? She paused to look at the chain she held out to make certain the key was still there.
It was,
and she frowned, confused.
I didn't come here for that. The key is yours.
Despite her foreknowledge of the meeting, this she hadn't expected, and she stood holding the key in her hand,
the little chain dangling.
Why?
Birthday present. I'm sure I missed one. Most of them, I think. You need a really good gift to make up for that many.
Uriel lowered her arm, her hand still clutching Eaton's key. She continued to glare. He was being charming, which meant he was up to something dreadful.
Why?
Because I trust you.
You shouldn't. She said it with intentional venom. She felt it important to remind Turin just how much she hated, how much she loathed him.
I know. Her father shrugged in that irritatingly sensible way of his, the way that disguised the monster he was. But one has to start somewhere.
Silence. She watched him, studied his face.
She was wrong. He did look different. She didn't know how, but he appeared older somehow, or maybe just tired.
Why give it to me?
Why now? Is it because Trilos has escaped and you think I won't use it?
He showed no hint of expression on his face. No sneer, no eye-rolling, none of the familiar contempt.
I want you to hold it until you are ready to forgive me. Then?
She laughed so loudly it sounded like a cackle and disturbed the nearby birds. She shook her hands at him, waving off any such ridiculous notion.
I can never forgive you.
Her voice was raised. She expected that. It shook. This surprised her.
Not after what you did. Not after all you did.
He chose to skip over her comments. Then, when you are ready to forgive me, I want you to use it.
Use it?
Yes. To let them all out. She narrowed her eyes at him.
I don't understand.
He looked surprised. He took a step closer, just one. His hand reached toward her.
What would she do if he dared to touch her?
The question wasn't answered, for he stopped. He studied her face, puzzled.
You can't see it, then.
See what? She asked, wondering if this was another trick, one more manipulation. Her father was an expert at steering cataclysmic events. He could throw a pebble into a pond, and if he did it early enough, that simple action could change the fortunes of millions.
Is this a pebble or a lie?
He was speaking of the future. All of the Asira had some of the vision. Muriel wasn't one. She was second generation, and would have lacked the talent altogether, except her father had tricked her into eating Aluria's fruit. That single bite was all it took to do the damage, to make her immortal, and to give her the sight. Being Asira and having eaten an entire fruit made Turin's vision peerless, while Muriel's was hazy at best. She could see anywhere in the present, clearly, but the deeper into the future she peered, the foggier things got.
You'll understand when the day comes, he told her,
which will most certainly be when trees walk and stones talk.
She watched him, wondering if this was part of some master plan.
With him, it had to be.
You're not telling me something.
I rarely tell anyone anything.
He offered her a smile.
If I did, you might think less of me.
That's not possible.
She didn't know why she said it. The words just came out. Maybe she wanted to hurt him. That was usually the only reason she ever spoke with her father.
When he failed to reply to her declaration, she added, Trilos is looking for you.
Her tone was meant to have a vengeful quality. She was issuing a proclamation of doom, letting him know he wouldn't get away with everything. In reality, it felt more like spitting in the wind.
I heard. He'll be wanting to kill me, I suspect.
Can he?
He shrugged. You more than anyone know there are worse things than death. But yes, I think it's possible. Trilos is smart. He's probably already figured it out. Or soon will. That would be bad.
You in Pyre? The prison warden sentenced to being locked up?
You're very unpopular.
He did reach out then, as if to touch Muriel's face, and the question was answered. She recoiled.
Turin stood on the stoop, with his hand still out, forgotten, as he looked at her. Not shock. Her reaction wasn't unexpected. But the shift in his expression was sudden. A grimace of pain stole over him.
He lowered his arm, bowed his head, and looked at the ground between them. You really should be rooting for me, Moore. I know you don't believe it, but I'm trying to fix things.
Fix what?
Everything.
And you think you can? Do you see so far as that?
She expected he would say that he did. Such was his way.
Everyone knew he could see what would happen, but he used that knowledge against people. He lied about what he saw, so no one could trust his visions.
No, he told her. Not so far as that. And the maze keeps changing. One day I think I can. And the next, no. And now,
what?
Maybe I'm getting old. He shrugged. But I do hope that one day I can make it up to you. Some of it, at least. But I'm not very good at that.
At what?
Being good. It takes practice, I suspect. And I think I get it wrong a lot. I sacrificed Bryn. Did you know that? I sent her to her premature death.
Twice.
His shoulders slumped. I judged it was for good reason. Only things didn't work out the way they were supposed to. And then there's Persephone.
She just died. Did you know?
Probably not. You never met her. I ruined her life, too. Stole her one chance at true happiness. That's part of what brought me here.
This surprised Muriel. She believed everything always worked out the way her father wanted. Knowing the future made that a foregone conclusion. Or so she thought. Either he was lying again, or something else was happening.
She hated him. The fact had been the foundation of her universe for so long that this new development threatened to upend everything.
The unknown was always terrifying, and for the first time, she was afraid not of her father, but for him, for both of them. I did the same to Tressa, Turin said, and Tesh, and, well, the list goes on, doesn't it? Was I right? Was I wrong? I honestly don't know. I can't tell the difference between what I want and what is right. I don't know how. I believe Aluria could have taught me, but, well, with my track record, there's no one I can trust, right?
There was that face again. Tired. No. Exhausted. Wait here. She went back inside and grabbed an old satchel off the peg near the washbasin. She normally used it to gather mushrooms and berries. Returning to the doorway, she held it out. Take this. For once, she saw confusion on her father's face. A pleasing sight.
Why?
You can't waste time checking back with me.
Checking with you?
Stop lying! She yelled at him. This is why you came here. You know it. I know it. So just stop.
Her father didn't reply.
See, this is you being you, being awful. This is what you have to stop. Take the bag.
He took hold of the shoulder strap and studied the satchel.
He could be faking. Her father was the master of lies and deceit, evil and treachery, so this could all be an act. The one truth that lingered, the one pestering question that stopped her from completely giving up on him was, why? What did he stand to gain by coming there, by giving her the key?
Maybe he was up to something she couldn't see. He usually was. But it was also true that if anyone could fix the world, the one she would bet on, the only one she thought might be able to do it, was her father.
And if there is even the smallest chance he's telling the truth...
Muriel wasn't ready to bet on him, and she certainly wasn't going to root for him.
Still, I'll watch you.
This made his brows rise suspiciously.
I'll check in from time to time.
When I'm bored, she clarified.
Each time you do something I approve of, every time I feel my hatred of you lessen, I'll send you a... She thought a moment,
looking around. She caught sight of the bags of feathers and smiled. Grabbing a little white tuft, she held it up.
A feather.
Why?
It's a symbol of rising, of renewed spirit, an embodiment of hope.
He nodded, and she saw a smile rising.
You realize that even with my help, you have an extremely small chance of success.
He leaned over and peered inside the hut. You have a lot of feathers.
I was going to make pillars.
He looked down at the bag he held. So if I fill this up, do you think you can forgive me?
You won't manage to. It would take an eternity.
No, not that long. I'm sure I'll be finished before trees walk and stones talk. He winked. She smirked and held up the feather.
Small feathers, big bag.
What if I do?
She shrugged. Maybe. He nodded.
That's fair.
He looked at her, and for a moment, she thought he might try to touch her again. He didn't.
It will be a long time, I think, before we meet again.
I don't have your sight, but I'm guessing this is the last time we'll ever see each other.
So much faith in me. I'm overwhelmed. He looped the strap of the satchel over his head, letting it hang across his chest. He clapped it against his side and picked up the spear again. He offered a wave, but not a goodbye. He followed her front path, walking down toward the garden. When he was nearly to it, thunder cracked. Turin looked up, his mouth open.
Surprised again, she thought. Two miracles in one day. I'm on a roll.
He continued to stare skyward, as from out of the blue, a single downy feather descended. He held out his hand and caught it. Turin stared at his palm for a long, curious moment, then turned. I thought...
She showed him her empty hand. Don't cheat next time, or no feather.
Cheat? You want to do this?
Do it as a man. Not as Rex Ubelin. Sending people through pyre is an unfair advantage.
I no longer have the key, so that ought to be easy.
Her father looked back at the tiny white fluff in his hand and grinned. It's just a feather, she told him.
No, it's not. It's... He stopped and swallowed several times, then sucked in a shallow breath. It's... evidence that you hate me a little less.
A very little bit. The weight of a feather, in fact, she smirked.
It's a start, he waved to her. It is a start.
Malcolm kissed the feather and slipped it into the satchel. Pulling it shut, he continued on his way.
Muriel stood in her doorway, watching. Until he passed beyond the hill and out of sight.
Author's afterword. First, let me apologize for the recording quality of this afterword. Usually it would be recorded in a studio, but due to stay-at-home orders, I'm reading this from my office, which certainly isn't designed for its acoustics, and it's the first time I've used the software. So if you hear a dog barking, it's my neighbors. The last time I did an afterword was at the end of my last series, and so I felt it was fitting I do another at the end of this one. And don't worry, Robin's afterword will follow mine. Now, let's start at the beginning. Background and information. In February 2011, three critical things happened in my writing career. First, I finished the edits on Persepolis, the sixth and final novel of my debut series, The Rider Revelations. Second, Orbit, the fantasy imprint of Hachette Book Group, announced they would be picking up that series and re-releasing it. And third, I began work on my next novel. I had decided to rework the first serious manuscript I had ever penned. This wasn't my first novel. In fact, it was my ninth. But it was the first one I thought might have a chance of being published. Originally, I penned it in 1986 and titled it Wizards. It is the contemporary story of a man who accidentally receives the power to do just about anything. Inheriting such an ability initially led to selfish pursuits. Later, he discovers the power's origin and that there is another person with the same skills opposing him in a classic good versus evil scenario. Throughout the book, he must learn not only how to survive, but discover how to win in a battle where he is greatly outmatched. I liked the idea, but back in the mid-80s, I simply didn't know how to write well enough to produce a decent book. I felt confident that I now had this talent and skill to fix the problems. I re-entitled it Antithesis. I spent an entire year researching, reconstructing, and rewriting. Then I stopped because I was mistaken. The book didn't merely require a few corrections. It wasn't worthy to begin with. Rather than release a mediocre novel, I shelved a year's worth of work and walked away. By then, it had been 4 years since I had written a book. I had spent that time editing and publishing The Rider Revelations via two separate routes. Initially, it was released as a six-book self-published series, 2008 to 2010. Then afterward, through one of the largest publishers in the world. Orbit fast-tracked the series, and they released all six books in three two-book omnibus editions from November 2011 to January 2012. Given it had been so long since I had written an original manuscript, I began to wonder if I still could. For my next attempt, I started playing around with an origin story to my World of Alan, the tale of Nephron. Writing something as extensive as Rhaer generates a great deal of world-building, but very little of what I know actually makes it to the page. So I started contemplating what eventually became the Legends of the First Empire series. While I was doing that, the Rhaer books were being reintroduced to the world in a much bigger way than I could have done on my own, and a need for more Rhaer arose. My wife and more than a few newfound fans missed the pair, and in Robin's case, depression actually set in. She lamented that I could revisit Royce and Hadrian anytime I wanted to, but with her limited imagination, she was cut off from their adventures. And so I began writing the first two chronicles to sate her and to remind myself I could still spin a tale. Still, I was mindful that I needed to create something new. I was at a crossroads. I never had planned to be a fantasy writer. It just turned out that after 19 novels, it happened to be the fantasy genre that first gained traction. I suspect most authors are in no short supply of book ideas. I had dozens filling my head. I wanted to try my hand at science fiction, horror, and what-if books. There was no end to the number of tales that excited my imagination, but I was published now. And it wasn't only my desires that were in play. Orbit hoped for another fantasy series, and my readers wanted, and still do desire more, Royce and Hadrian. Doing something completely different might be asking too much of those who were now my supporters. The sophomore curse was upon me, and that might hinder acceptance of anything too different. I felt readers would be most accepting of another fantasy series, especially if it was set in the same world. But there was something else I needed to face. I had lied in the Rhaer revelations, and I felt terrible about leaving that unaddressed. A great deal of Alon's history, the mythology of the gods and the Navranian Empire's foundation, were garbled tales altered over the centuries. I knew this when I wrote Rhaera, and I felt a nagging need to reveal the truth. With that in mind, I returned to creating what I planned to be a little trilogy that would cover Nefron's story and the origin of the First Empire. My hope was to knock it out quickly, then move on to new worlds. That didn't happen. Legend's Origin Story. The story began its conception as a biography of Nefron, written mostly in his point of view. He and his band of valiant adventurers would be a platoon of soldiers in a rebellious territory where they were not wanted. Nefron would develop an atypical appreciation of humans, and when ordered to slaughter a village, he would refuse. The plot was designed to escalate from there, which was interesting, but weak. There wasn't enough there. The story grew as I studied Iron Age Britannic history, looking for inspiration. I added Wraith, the human hero warrior, and Persephone, the queen Boadicea of her people. I had the foundation for a love triangle building. Here is where the story entered its infancy, and I began writing what was then titled Rune. The other books would be neatly named Durg and Frey. I got off to a rocky start when I began the series. I went with a different style, one that resembled other fantasy writers who I had read since entering the genre. Usually no one, not even Robin, reads my books before they are finished, but I wanted to ensure I was on the right track. I wasn't. Her response was, "I'm not sure who wrote this, but I would much rather read a book by Michael J. Sullivan. Can you please tell him that?" She was right. Instead of trying to be someone else, I went back to being me. Another major piece of the series fell into place when I decided to drop Nefron's point of view and focus on Persephone and Wraith. In this version, Nefron had his group of warriors, Persephone had her misfits, and Wraith was a loner. But a funny thing happened. In building the Galantians, I realized they were unforgivably dull. A bunch of variously skilled warriors was not only boring, but they were also cliched. No matter how much I tried to breathe life into their characters, they remained flat. On the other hand, Persephone's group exploded onto the page. They had depth and emotion and humor. I found myself drawn more and more to them. As a result, the Galantians faded into the background. At the same time, Ciri, Moya, Roan, Gifford, Padira, and Bryn started to take center stage. I was halfway through what would become Age of Myth, altered when Del Rey didn't care for the use of so many invented terms for book titles, that I realized I didn't want to write a story about Nefron and his Galantians at all. I desired a different kind of story, a better one. Suddenly, the series stopped being something I wanted to quickly breeze through, and it became important to me. The message. One of the things I was looking to accomplish in this series has to do with Albert Schatz. Or to be more precisely, people like him. Albert discovered the second antibiotic after penicillin and one that cured tuberculosis and many other horrific bacterial-based illnesses. Unfortunately, Albert was a subordinate. His supervisor, Selman Waksman, took credit for carefully erasing Albert's name from documents and keeping him away from meetings where he might gain recognition. Waksman won the Nobel Prize, and Albert Schatz has been mostly forgotten. Likewise, the astronomer Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and I'm sure I got those names mispronounced, suffered a similar lack of recognition because she was the woman in a male-dominated field. And then there's Albert Einstein's wife, Mileva Meric. She was a genius in her own right, but other than fellow Serbians, most don't know anything about her. The list of individuals who improved the world but, due to the prevalent culture or minority status, have nearly been lost to our collective memory is staggering. This made me wonder, how many in the history of Alon have been forever forgotten? This notion became a driving factor in the Legend series as I aimed to reveal the truth regarding historical facts that would later be usurped by those in power. In Rhaera, unlikely heroes meant skilled and strong men who weren't particularly virtuous and therefore unlikely to do good deeds. In legends, I sought to present truly unlikely heroes, the sort that had no hope of being great and no chance of changing the world. I realized this was what had made Tolkien's work so profound to me as a boy. Hobbits are unlikely heroes because no halfling could be expected to take on the might of Sauron, but they also are not children. They did not grow up and become heroes. They always were. They just didn't know it. To me, that was the genius of Tolkien's work. Through his hobbits, the reader follows innocent, seemingly powerful characters sent into unfathomable horror. I was riveted while wondering how they could possibly survive, much less succeed. This is one of the ideas I wanted to convey through my series, both as a means to captivate readers, but also as a message of hope that ordinary people can achieve extraordinary accomplishments. I wanted to remind us that the disadvantaged can win, and they've done so many times. I know such things are possible, because I'm just such a hobbit who once dreamed of being an author. The Big Mistake. Armed with this new plan, the series' focus shifted in the middle of Age of Myth and blossomed in Age of Swords. This second book steered away from the tired hero-warrior destined to save the world and moved toward the band of broken misfits who team up to win. And that's one of the reasons why it became my favorite book in the series. I finished my planned trilogy with Age of War, which concluded many of my story arcs, but Robin was quick to point out that there was still much to do. Like, what about the damn door? And what's up with Trilos and Malcolm? I also had been operating under a mistaken assumption that people reading Legends would have first read Rhaera, and as such, they knew who won the war. I was left facing a series of repetitious battles which did not excite me in the slightest. But there was also the ability to explain some of the background information that was known only to myself. For instance, in Rhaera, it is the elves rather than humans who have Galarabrin, so how did that first come about? Frustrated by my own short-sightedness and without clear direction, I began writing one more book to finish out the war. It was going to be bad. I knew that before I started. It was just me going through motions of completing previously referred to events, hoping to find my way as I went. And then, the joke that wasn't. So my new book began with Ciri being captured and taken to Estremadon, leaving the others to rescue her. They held a meeting to discuss how to do that. All the characters pitched ideas, and they struggled to find a way to cross the impassable Nedwalden. Bryn suggested they were legends of secret Crimble doorways where you entered in one place but came out somewhere else. Only hearing this, Tekchen made a joke. There is a door in the center of Estremadon. If we come out there, we can easily get to Ciri. And only problem is it leads to the afterlife, so we'd all need to die to use it. I assumed this was nothing more than a clever bit of humor for about 10 seconds. Then I thought, what if... No, that's stupid. But it could work on so many levels. No, it'd be too hard. There's way too much heavy lifting. In that instant, a cosmos of ideas rushed in. I could make exploring the bowels of Pyre into a whole new world that would be worthy of a novel. I could draw on Dante's Divine Comedy and The Trials of Hercules, both works that fit the era of myth that I was aiming at all along. Doing so could fully explain the door, Trilos, Malcolm, and so much more. I could do what I did at the end of Rhaera, where I pulled in all the previously met characters for a big finale, but this time I could include historical people as well. I'd be able to reveal the full truth about the gods. From there, I saw the chance to not only tell the origin story of the Empire, but of the whole world. That did it. I wanted to write this story. I needed to write it. Challenges. I faced a lot of problems right from the get-go. The biggest was, if everyone was already dead, where was the threat? And if there is no threat, where is the tension? Without that, the story would be dull and boring. Also, what were the mechanics? How would they die? How could they come back? Would they be spirits or keep their bodies in the afterlife, a la Greek myth? The biggest dilemma was, if my party had to die to enter the afterlife, then Ciri would have to as well. Clearly, I had issues. I ended up solving most of these problems easily enough, but I was faced with one insurmountable obstacle. This new tale was much larger than a single book. If I was honest with myself, it was on the same scale as everything I'd written in the series up to that point, but I wasn't going to let that stop me. My attempt to condense everything into one novel resulted in a Cliff Notes version of the story. Upon reading the results, my wife let me know I'd failed. Too rushed, too many missed opportunities for high drama, not enough emotional impact. It reads like a textbook rather than a novel. Fine. I went back and gradually expanded the tale. This was difficult because I didn't have a good place to divide the story. Unlike my other books, where everything neatly ties up, these characters were engaged in ongoing quests that would require being suspended mid-story. It wasn't unlike how Tolkien's Lord of the Rings had been released, and I felt the similarity was a bit eerie, but in a good way. I hated not being able to provide a wrapped-up ending for readers, but I was pleased with how the story was shaping up. In this second version, the fourth book divided as they entered Nephril. I knew it was better, but not great. Robin agreed that I still had too much in too little space. A sixth book would be required, and so I rolled back to the end of the Age of War and started rewriting the end of the Great War for the third time. Even with the expanded page count, I still was forced to cut large sections and topics I simply didn't have time to address. Some examples include additional background on Gath and Melon and Bran and Attila and Havar and Sile Longhammer and many others. Of course, now I had to divide the story twice. And interestingly, new breakpoints were starting to reveal themselves. My newly expanded tale had two exhilarating climaxes, both of which occurred at places that evenly divided the single long story into three normal-sized novels. Rather than shy away from the problem, I embraced it. Instead of artificially creating quiet moments, I cut the book at these times of high drama, cliffhangers. I'm sure everyone is familiar with the technique. Television series season finales often end with cliffhangers. And the entire concept goes back to Western serials, which were designed to keep magazine subscriptions high. I felt if I had to incorporate the technique, I wanted to make the best cliffhanger I could. I knew I'd get pushback from readers. However, I suspected then, and still believe now, that once all the books are available, the irritation of having to wait will fade to the land of when I was oh so young and the troubles I had to face. I'm sure some are wondering why I didn't just create a single massive volume. Well, it isn't because I'm trying to maximize income, nor was it, as some have accused, a ploy by my publisher, which, by the way, is me. There are several reasons. First, the book would be hugely inconsistent with the other installments, and I like the symmetry we now have with those two closely related trilogies. Second, it would have added years to the release date of the follow-up to Age of War. And lastly, the cost of production for the hardcover would be far higher than three separate novels. Why? Because we'd have to switch to Smith-sewn bindings, which is usually reserved for textbooks and volumes in law libraries. Fun facts. Some readers have accused me of killing the main character, meaning Wraith. When I heard this, I was shocked, except in very early conceptualization, he was never expected to be a primary character. In retrospect, I realized that part of the reason people elevated his importance was that the opening scene of the book begins with him, or appears to. The reality is, it doesn't. The first character mentioned in the series is Bryn, and she has been my main character all along. The fact that you don't discover this until the very end is something that provides me a great deal of amusement. Aside from her, the other primary protagonists were Persephone, Ciri, and Malcolm. These four people carry the story. It is their actions that move the plot forward, and the rest provide them with support. There are a fair number of homages in this series. The White Brick Road of Rell, the Wicked Queen Feral, and Roan extinguishing her with water are but a few references to The Wizard of Oz. The chapter Astray in a Gloomy Wood is in deference to the start of Dante's Inferno, as is the name of the Belgric Lungarian seer, Beatrice. Also inspired by Dante are guides to the various realms of the underworld. Originally, Arion was the guide in Rell, and she did quite a bit of explaining as to how things worked in the land of the dead. Through the various edits, we now have the characters make many of the discoveries, yet I still have Fenelaus as the guide in Nephril and Wraith in Elysian. Oh, and here's a fun fact for Rhaera Chronicle readers. In case you haven't figured it out, I'll reveal the identity in a secret-coded non-spoiler message to those who are well-versed in my world. Ready? Yes, it was Macaretta. Themes and tributes. Redemption and forgiveness are central points of focus in both Rhaera and Legends, although in both cases you don't discover this until you're very near the end. Legends place a greater emphasis on finding the courage to forgive oneself, something that everyone can probably relate to. Selflessness and the ability of people to rise to the occasion when times are dire is also shared between the two series. A noble sentiment that we are seeing played out daily at this particular time in our own history. There are more connections and references to other works, other subtle themes as well. I will leave these discoveries to those who enjoy such things. A word about heroes. Finally, I must say a few words in recognition of the one person who, if you enjoyed this series, are most indebted to. My wife, Robin. She has been your secret advocate for many, many years. As my alpha reader, she provides my first and most trusted feedback and helps shape my novels more than anyone. These last three books were in an abnormally poor condition when she first received the tales. This was mainly due to them being constructed outside my usual process. Instead of a well-defined structure, I was working in the ad hoc chaos of trial and error. If not for her, the results might have been terrible. At times, I was throwing ideas at her just to see what stuck. We fought many an epic battle over details, both large and small. Luckily, Robin has a strong personality and was able to stand up to me and make her opinions known, revealing some uncomfortable truths. Not an easy task. Tears have been shed. But the story is far better because of her courage and tireless efforts to make this the best story possible. I offered to put her name on the cover because she deserves it, but she refused. I offered to dedicate this series to her, as I did with the final Rhaera volume. Again, she opposed the idea. Instead, she provided the Tolkien quote to reflect the difficult times in which this novel was written. Rather than take credit, she chose to offer hope to our readers. The stories I write might be fantasy, but the depiction of the feelings people share for each other are real. The unlikely heroes, some who we never see or hear, are real as well. They are out among us right now, risking their lives and those of their loved ones. They are sacrificing all they have to help save the world. If you take anything away from this story beyond distracting entertainment, consider remembering this Book of Bryn quote. I had always worshipped heroes in stories. I had no idea I was surrounded by them. Thank you.
Robin's afterword. Hey all, Robin here. I'm back. I hope you'll bear with me for this recording. Usually it's done in a studio, with others helping me with the engineering tasks. But travel isn't possible right now due to stay-at-home orders, so I'm making do from our little cabin in Luray. And it was not designed for audio recording. So if the quality is not up to our usual standards, hopefully you'll focus on the content rather than the delivery. So first, I'd like to once again offer my thanks for all the complimentary things people have been saying about my afterwards. It's one of the reasons I keep doing them. Well, we are done. It's been a very long time coming. How long? You know, I'm not 100% sure, but I do remember seeing a very early version of Chapter 1 of the first book in April of 2013. So that's 6 books in 7 years, which doesn't sound all that impressive. But during that time, we also released Hollow World, Michael's sci-fi thriller, and all 4 of the Ryeiro Chronicles. So that makes 11 books in 6 years, a feat I'm pretty proud to be a part of. Since Michael started publishing books in 2008, he's released 1 or 2 books every year. Here's how they break down. Years with 1 book releases include 2008, 2012, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2019. Years with 2 books occurred in 2009, 2010, 2011, 2013, 2018, and 2020. Recently, we put out 3 books in 10 months, which was more than grueling. For the audiobook recordings, the date of which is set well in advance, I was doing copy edits in a just-in-time fashion. This meant I was emailing Tim's chapters at 2 o'clock a.m. for a 10 a.m. recording. Now, it turns out that everything worked out well, but I was more than exhausted by the process. Is this all a preamble leading to something? Yes. For the next series, of which Michael has 2 books finished, neither of which I've read, they will be coming out once a year, because we can't continue with such a pace. The good news is, there are no cliffhangers. I know there are more than a few people who wait until all books in a series are released before they start with the first one, so now is a good time to binge. I'm looking forward to a full series reread myself. It'll be a great deal of fun to just sit back and enjoy the tale, rather than looking for plot holes, consistency errors, or typos. I can't wait. For those who might be curious about such things, I did a series tally. If you take out the non-story elements such as table of contents, author's notes, afterwards, glossaries, and the like, the entire series weighs in with the following statistics. 181 chapters, 2,763 pages, which are 8.5 by 11 inches, formatted with 12-point font, and a total of 766,699 words. Okay, let's dig into my impressions of this book and the series as a whole. Well, first and foremost, it's clear that this is Brynn's book, not to be confused with the Book of Brynn. Brynn is certainly center stage, and now we get to see how important her masterwork is. The fact that it disappears makes a great deal of sense because the mythology of the gods in the Ryeiro books is quite different, and I suspect that's due to Brynn's books being snatched up by Trilos. Will it show up again? I have no idea. As I said, I've not read any of the books in the next series, but I do recall at least a passing mention of a scholar of ancient text in Ryeiro with the name Fairlane. And we know that the second book of the new series is also called that, so I suspect if nothing else, she'll be searching for the full Book of Brynn. Okay, now for something that might sound odd. I love that Brynn died. From a story standpoint, it prevents her from recreating what Trilos stole. But more importantly, I think her returning to Pyre is the only chance that Tesh and Tressa have. In her last scene, it was evident, at least to me, that they had no possibility of getting out by themselves. Still, I'm 100% sure that Brynn will be able to rescue them. With enough persuasion, she may be able to convince them to climb out on their own. But if that doesn't work, I'm sure she can make a sling and carry each one out strapped to her back. After all, we've seen it's possible to use Eshem in the Abyss, even if it's not easy to do. After all, both Ivor and Gifford managed it. Ivor was managed to create the figurine of Rhone's mother, and Gifford made his sword appear when his anger against Ivor was at a peak. Another aspect about her death that I loved is her crying out, "Hang on, Tesh, I'm coming." It's a direct repeat of Ciri's proclamation to the near-dead Arian at the end of Age of Swords. So fun. And yes, I just use fun in the context of someone's death. Now, some beta readers wanted to have another scene with Brynn while in Pyre, and there may even be some future readers looking for the same thing. I can understand the desire, but personally, I think it would have been a colossal mistake. I mean, it's not like we don't know what's going to happen. And to have a scene showing her return would be treading over old ground. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that Tesh and Bryn have a cozy little place on a hill overlooking a river in Elysian that's just a stone's throw away from Race and Persephone's home. For me, I don't have to see the reunion to know what happens. Which brings me to another issue. I'm okay with Tesh remaining dead. If he were to return to the land of the living, there would be a whole host of problems. First, he would be apart from Bryn. Second, he would be tried and punished for the murders of the Glantians. And third, Nifrun's destruction of Duria and Nadak would come out, and that's really something you don't want to know about your new emperor. Since Elysian is so idyllic, staying dead means Tesh will get to his final reward sooner. I'm good with that. I mentioned in one of my other afterwards that I couldn't figure out whether Malcolm was good or evil. So imagine my surprise when he turned out to be both. For people planning to read the Rhaer Revelations, keep your eyes open for tales about Kyle and the White Feather. When you come across them, you'll know the true origin of where those stories come from. Okay, so one of the highlights of this book has to be the reunion of Suri and Mina. I'm thrilled that the pair are returning to the Hawthorn Glen and a well-deserved simpler life. Suri deserves a rest. She went through a lot. Oh, and I'm so glad that one of my fears didn't come to pass. I was really concerned that Suri's friendship with Macaretta would result in yet another Gilarabrin. In general, I'm not able to change Michael's mind on big plot issues, and I'm glad we didn't have to duke it out over that one. Michael never treats death capriciously, and at the time of Mina's passing, I totally understood her need to die from a story standpoint. Still, that knowledge didn't make me cry any less. But I still understood it. I never thought we would see her again. Now, not only is she alive, but we find out she is much more than we first imagined. The fact that Trilos didn't want to face off against her was quite telling. I loved it. Another personal favorite of mine is getting all the lore about the afterlife. Throughout the last two books, we visited Rel, Nifril, Elysian, the Abyss, and the Sacred Grove. And it was great learning about them through the progression of the plot, rather than through an info dump. I'm glad that people in Elysian get their loved ones to come along. I don't think paradise would be as wonderful if someone you love were stuck in a different realm. I really enjoyed meeting Mara, and although I didn't expect to meet Alan, I loved that we got to hear the full story of Turin from the source. Oh, and while I'm here, I know some people have been a bit confused by all the various gods, and they've been asking for a summary, so here it is. Eaton is the god of the sky, grandfather of all. Elan is goddess of the earth, grandmother of all. Aluria is the firstborn of Eaton and Elan, goddess of plants and animals. Her fruit bestows immortality. She is now a dead tree in the sacred grove. Typhons are ancient gods of giants. There are three of them, Gar, Earl, and Toth. Currently, they are trapped in the abyss of Nifril. Assyria are the five gods created by Elan after stealing Eaton's teeth. Their names are Turin, Trilos, Drome, Feral, and Mara. Turin goes by many names. He is also known as Rex Uberlin, Caraticus, and Malcolm. He is the father of goblins, also known as Gazelle, and the bringer of war and lies. Trilos has a number of names, too. He is known as the Three, the Old One, or the Ancient One. He was the first to die by Turin's hand and was the lover of Muriel. He escaped the abyss by tricking the dwarves. Drome is the twin of Feral and father of the Belgric Lugrians, who are called dwarfs by the humans. In the afterlife, he rules Rel. Feral is the twin of Drome and mother of Frey. In the afterlife, she rules Nifril. Mara is the mother of the runes, also known as humans. In the afterlife, she rules Elysian. Muriel is the daughter of Turin and lover of Trilos, and she is commonly known as the Tetlin Witch. Like Malcolm, she is immortal because she ate Aluria's fruit. Okay, getting back to my favorite things regarding this book, and that is its ending. As far as I'm concerned, I think Michael nailed it. I loved, loved, loved that it closes with Malcolm and Muriel, and that she gave him the first of what I hope to be many feathers. The fact that she's open to reconnecting with her father makes me all warm and fuzzy, but I fear she will be a tough judge. Well, I could go on and on, but I only have so much time, and recording makes me very nervous, making every minute seem much, much longer. But if you are interested in more commentary from me, I am writing a Making Of bonus ebook. If you are a Kickstarter backer, you'll receive it automatically. If you weren't, you can get a free copy by requesting it at michaeljsullivan.survey.fm/making-of-legends-ebook. Before I go, I want to take a moment to talk to those people who haven't yet read the Rhaer Revelations. Please do. There are so many connections between Legends and Rhaera that it's really worth checking out. Plus, having read Legends, you'll be in the know, making you better equipped to see through Michael's lies. Also, if you think you might like what we are calling the Bridge series, also known as Rise and the Fall, we'll be doing Kickstarters for it as well. And if you want to sign up for early notification, you can do so at michaeljsullivan.survey.fm/ks-notify. Okay, one more thing I'd like to cover, and then I'll be off. I'd like to thank the members of our creative team whose incredible efforts made this book possible. First, to Mark Simonetti, who not only created the fantastic cover for this book, but all the books in the series. Next, I'd like to thank Lynn Brenham and Laura Jordsted, two fabulous copy editors who worked under incredibly aggressive timelines. Hopefully, we'll have more breathing room with the next series. And of course, we can't forget to mention Tim Gerard Reynolds, the amazing narrator for the book. Usually, Michael and I are in the studio during the recording, and Tim has the helping hands of a recording engineer and frequently a director. But because of the coronavirus, Tim recorded in his home studio, which meant he had to wear multiple hats. We received the dailies and reported back areas where adjustments were required. He took care of those before sending them off to Audible. Because Tim had to wear so many hats, the recording took longer than usual. However, we were still able to meet the release day, so good job to Tim and the post-production mastering people at Audible. I would also like to thank an army of beta, gamma, and early Kickstarter readers who contributed their selfless time and effort to make this book as good as it is. Normally I would call these people out by name, but the deadline was so tight that there wasn't time for the coordination involved in getting permission to use their names. So even though they aren't listed here, I still want to publicly offer our thanks. Last and not least, I'd like to thank the various logistics support individuals, for instance the people at Grim Oak Press, especially Sean Speakman, who handles the distribution for the hardcovers and paperbacks. I'd also like to thank the people at LSC Communications, who provided the printing during the height of the coronavirus. And of course, my continued thanks to the people at Audible Studios, especially Esther Buchner and Kristen Lang. And that's it for me. Both Michael and I would like to thank you for your continued support. We'll do our best to keep the books coming, and hopefully you'll find them worth your time to continue reading.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Age of Empire, written by Michael J. Sullivan, performed by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2020 by Michael J. Sullivan. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.